Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
On this episode of ID the Future, Jerusalem Post columnist Jonathan Rosenblum directly addresses the question, is Darwin kosher? As we feature a clip from his talk at Discovery Institute in Seattle. Rosenblum discusses the Orthodox community's response to the implications of Darwinism and concludes by laying out why Darwinism is not compatible with Judaism.
My own impression is that the Jewish community, the traditional Jewish community, the Orthodox Jewish community, was a little bit slower than some elements of the Christian community in identifying some of the implications of Darwinian evolution. I want to always use the term Darwinian here, not the question of evolution, whether there are morphological changes in species over time, but Darwinian evolution, which we'll get to in a second in its definition. But I think that the Orthodox Jewish community was somewhat different in its response and somewhat belated in its response to the implications, which were obvious to Christian divines from the time that Darwin first published On the Origin of Species. And there's a discussion of it in Jewish sources, but I don't think it ever became a terribly important issue for us. And I'll describe some of those reasons. The first reason, I think, is that Orthodox Jews live a very complicated life. There's a lot to do. We have 613 basic commandments which guide every aspect of our daily existence. We are very involved in what we have to do at every moment. Sometimes this is put in the dichotomy, which I think is a false dichotomy, of Christianity as a religion of faith and Judaism as a religion of law. But there is an element of truth to that in the extent that the legal aspects of Judaism are much more fully developed than you would find in terms of detailing every aspect of a person's life than you would find in classical Christian thought. And that being the case, I think it was easier for religious Jews to focus upon the observance of the law and leave aside some of the larger theological issues that may have Darwinianism raised. Put those aside for a moment. There's a second reason, which I think is even perhaps more important, certainly more important. We never really had the same problem with Darwin as confronts some Christian sects, the question of biblical literalism. There's a very major difference between Judaism and Christianity in the sense of its of how it is textually based. In other words, within the Jewish tradition, there is the written, the five books of Moses, which are the basic canonical text, and they're referred to as the written Torah. But the written Torah was given along in Jewish tradition with the oral Torah, which is compiled in the Talmud, various midrashim, which are comments, rabbinical commentaries on each verse. There are many, many verses, sometimes many commentaries as well, many rabbinical commentaries as well, on the words of the written Torah. The written Torah, in our view, in many respects, cannot be understood independent of the oral Torah. Many of the commandments simply would be unintelligible if we didn't have the rabbinic glosses and the oral Torah, which is viewed as equally binding upon us as the written Torah. So that meant, and many of the midrashim, many of the rabbinical comments do take a verse out of its literal meaning. There are many cases where the Talmud takes a verse out of its literal meaning. For instance, a punishment may be prescribed as 40 lashes for a particular crime, and the rabbis interpret this as 39, and they explain why, how they learn this, what hermeneutical principles cause them to learn this out. But in any event, you find many cases, many, many cases, with which the tradition always encompassed readings which could be seen as non-literal readings of the text. So that made us less sensitive than, particularly with respect to the creation, Bereshit or Genesis, the creation stories that are included in the Torah. In addition to that, I'll tell you what I was told. When I first came to Yeshiva about 28 years ago, when I first came to learn full time after the University of Chicago and Yale Law School and practicing law when that first change in my life came about. And I don't think that this is a false, I don't think this was a false statement. I think it was to some extent true, is I was quoted when I started asking questions about creation. I was told basically by my rabbi, who's a prominent Rosh Hashiva, prominent head of a major seminary in America today. He said as follows. He said, everything that is found in Bereshis, in the first chapters of Genesis, is a mystery. And the Rambam, Maimonides, one of the preeminent medieval commentators, probably the preeminent medieval commentator, the greatest thinker, one of the phrases that was once used about him, Maimonides is Moses ben Maimon. From Moses to Moses, there was not another like him. So this gives you a sense of his prominence in Jewish thought. So Maimonides, I was told, says that if we would be compelled by overwhelming evidence to reinterpret the verses of Genesis, then we would do so. If the evidence were overwhelming that they had to be understood, we would understand that this is a mystery and we would find another way to interpret these words. The proof of this is, or at least in Maimonides' view, was that there is a specific, that in the Talmud it says that among the things that you cannot teach in public, in a large-scale gathering, are the mysteries of Maisa Bereshis, the mysteries of creation, from which the Rambam understood, the Maimonides understood, that we are dealing here with a text which is at best simply hinting at much deeper secrets and much larger processes, and that's really beyond our ken. But in any event, the assumption was that we would be free in the face of compelling scientific evidence to re-understand whether the issue was the age of the universe or the issue was the order of creation and so forth and so on. Any of these issues would be open in the face of overwhelming scientific evidence to reinterpretation. So this is another reason why I think for believing Jews, the implications of Darwinian thought were less immediately obvious and of less immediate impact on our day-to-day existence and on issues of faith. As long as we were fully involved in the observance of the law, I think we troubled ourselves less about whether the underlying implications. I should say that in this room is sitting one of those people, my friend David Klinghoffer, who doesn't let us forget the implications of our beliefs, who's right on top. I mean, of the many sentences of his which have stuck in my mind, the one that sticks in my mind most prominently is his statement about the Torah's account of the giving of the five books of Moses at Sinai, which he said, either this happened or it didn't happen. Don't make me up any stories. Did it happen or didn't happen? Because if it didn't happen, we might as well all go home and convert to another religion. There's no point in remaining Jewish. You can't get away from that. But I'm just explaining sociologically, anthropologically, however you will, why I think these issues were less pressing. But there is an inherent tension, and this erupted in full blast within recent years. There's an inherent tension. On the one hand, we have a written and we have an oral Torah. We have possibilities of interpretation, and those interpretations are themselves sacrosanct. We have allegorizing tendencies which have risen from time to time in Jewish history. As long as you're not bound by the literal text, is absolutely everything in the text is true. Everything in the Torah is true, in our view. But you have to know what is it saying, and that cannot be read by us alone. That's based on a transmission of an oral tradition. But the tension was, how far would this go? And there has erupted periodically throughout Jewish history major battles about how far would it be possible to allegorize particular verses in the Torah. One of the major disputes that arose was in the 13th century, late 12th and 13th century, over Maimonides himself, over the accusations of many that his Guide to the Perplexed, his major philosophical tract, was dangerously infected with Aristotelian philosophy, was apologetic vis-a-vis Aristotelian philosophy, that he had gone too far, and that, and he and others would in his wake go further in giving rational in what was called his rationalism, and his rationalism with respect to biblical miracles, most famously, or in the famous passage where the three visitors come to Abraham and tell him that Sarah will bear a child, and they come with this message. That Maimonides, uniquely among all the commentators, explained, and for philosophical reasons, he had a reason for this, explained that this was a vision and not something that actually happened, because in his view, angels could never take a corporeal form. They could never take a bodily form. And therefore, Abraham didn't really see them. He dreamed that he saw them. And there were many. There were many who saw that this philosophizing trend, this the importation of Aristotle into Jewish thought, had implications and dangers, and warned against it, to the point that many of Maimonides' books were burned. Today, in yeshivas, perhaps the most fundamental text, one of the texts that is argued about most, and more ink has been spent in the interpretations of the Maimonides' specific halachic decisions, the most revered figure. But in that time, his books were burned, and sometimes involving figures who were no less, or not that much less, eminent in their domain. Some of the very greatest figures were involved in the campaign against Maimonidean philosophy. If you want to read a good book on this, Beryl Septimus, a professor at Harvard, has a book called The Meir Abulafia, The Maimonidean Controversy. It's a short book, but excellent on this point. Now, we look back at this dispute today and we say, well, those opponents who burned the books of the Rambam, the books of the Maimonides, were clearly mistaken. In fact, that's not as clear as we might think. The Nachmanides, one of the greatest of his contemporaries and slightly after him in time, said already in his time, those who were attracted to philosophy, those who were most attracted to philosophy, generally were very lax in their observance of the commandments. And by the time of the expulsion from Spain 200 years later, it was clear, the Chassid Yavetz, one of the writers of that time, describing those who were expelled, said they mostly came from those who had not been attracted to philosophy. They remained faithful to Jewish practice, where those who had been attracted from the upper classes, who had been attracted to philosophy, had largely been swept away. They had lost the observance of the commandments, and they either went underground as Muranos, or they had simply tried to meld themselves into the surrounding Christian culture of that time. So, you know, we may look back and say, because of the eminence of Maimonides, that they were clearly wrong. It's not so. It's not so obvious. Another stage in Jewish history where this erupted was in the 18th century, post-Enlightenment, around the figure of Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn was himself an observant Jew in every respect. But he gathered around him a group of disciples, and he was also one of the great humanists of the German Enlightenment. He was a figure who was celebrated as the pinnacle of which a human being could strive to by a German writer Lessing in one of his plays, I think it was called Moses the Just. He was very involved in contemporary intellectual debates. And there again, the issue was the extent to which he would emphasize the idea behind each commandment. What was the idea? There were great suspicions raised about Mendelssohn himself, but that he was clearly observant, that no one charged differently. But they were highly suspicious of this enterprise of giving the philosophical idea behind each particular commandment. In any event, by two generations, his grandson was the composer Frederick Mendelssohn. He did not have a single descendant who was still a Jew, much less an observant Jew, all had found their way to their baptismal font. Of his students, none of them remained faithful, observant Jews. The idea that you could abstract the idea behind the commandments, so they said, okay, so we'll take the idea and let's forget about the commandments themselves. We don't need that. Now, we can understand. We're so brilliant. We can understand the commandments. We can summarize this. I'm just giving you a little background on how these non-literal, these attempts to either bring philosophy or to reconcile Judaism to other systems, to reconcile them either to science or to reconcile them to the contemporary philosophical doctrines of a particular time, have resulted in major confrontations. 2 years ago, again, the issue arose with respect to books by somebody who was personally a friend of mine, somebody who had spent many Sabbath meals at our home, by the name of Natan Slifkin, who undertook to try and reconcile most of the difficult questions which confront a Jew coming from a secular, non-religious background when he faces the Torah, and to show that each one of these could, in fact, be reconciled. His works were basically unknown or certainly not read widely, but at some point, somebody called attention to them to various rabbinical eminences, some of whom were also my teachers, and I was personally torn asunder by this controversy. It's a controversy which is not abated to this day. It's a controversy which found its way recently into the Wall Street Journal, which Bruce mentioned in his introduction. And the title of that article, it was the title of this speech, is Darwin Kosher. There, Rabbi Slifkin, who gives no quarter in this debate or is described as giving no quarter, says, appreciating the role and rule of natural law is an essential prerequisite to appreciating the role and rule of the spiritual law in the Torah. I think that's generally a fair point. Judaism is not anti-scientific. The same, and his point is, until we understood that there was an ordered universe, that in some sense, the idea of a creator who imposed order on the universe, who created the world and created it with an order, is a basis for scientific thought. If there is no order in the world, how can you derive scientific laws? How can you even find scientific laws? On that point, I think Slifkin is right. That wasn't the controversial point. The point, what I think made this dispute even more fierce than it might otherwise have been, was that, and this is an issue that comes up again, Natan Slifkin is a 27, 28-year-old young man. He is not an eminent Torah scholar. He is a person who feels extremely confident of his own powers, his own originality, and was not one who was interested in being told anything. And he wrote, and I think it was in some ways the tone as much as what he actually wrote, a tone of dismissiveness of the knowledge of our sages, the sages of the Talmud, with respect to scientific evidence, an attempt to take the allegorizing tendency, which I said is always a possibility, is always part of that inherent tension in Jewish thought, to a great extreme, and simply treat himself as if he was Maimonides. I mean, it's one thing when Maimonides says something, the greatest figure of his generation, and acknowledged as such by all his contemporaries, even those who called for the burning of his books, understood his greatness. Natan Slifkin, for all that he's an intelligent young man, is not Maimonides. And his willingness to put himself in those shoes also created a sort of sense that something was amiss here, and left far enough, if the justification was we have to make the Torah accessible and believable and compatible with modern science, whatever that science of the time tells us, then we've put the Torah in a subservient position. We've shown ourselves a lack of confidence in it as the ultimate source of truth. You have to understand, in Jewish tradition, the Torah is not just a law, a set of moral commandments which are given to man. It is the blueprint for creation. It's the blueprint, as a Kabbalistic statement, a famous Kabbalistic statement frequently quoted, says, God looked into the Torah and created the world. The Torah pre-exists the world. It is the divine blueprint, meaning that among other things, among the corollaries of this, is that those that many of the natural laws could be derived from the Torah. Maimonides himself, for instance, just a random example, was the first person that we know of to write that pi is an irrational, that pi is an irrational number. Before this point was ever, that it doesn't repeat at any point, that this, about 500 years before this was, you know, definitively concluded by others. There are other examples, their knowledge of that the liver regenerates and how that a person, that an animal or a person from whom a large part of the liver had been cut off was not necessarily bound to die within a year, which has certain implications in Jewish law. They discovered this long before it was known to contemporary medicine and so forth. There are examples which would suggest, well, they must have had another source of knowledge. This was something that the Slifkin dispensed with easily, casually, as it were. He said, well, you know, they made mistakes. They wrote in the science of their time. Their knowledge of scientific matters was limited to this. It was this, I think the smell, what the Torah authorities who came out so strongly against him, there was something that they smelled. That's what I was pointing about out by Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn himself was fully observant. Nathan Slifkin is fully observant. No one questions his level of observance of the commandments. The question was, is there something here that's extremely dangerous? And on that, the sense of contemporaries has always been very good, whether it was the sense of the contemporaries, even of Maimonides, that there was a danger in the hyper-rationalism which was taking hold among those who were following in Maimonides' path, or whether in the time of Mendelssohn, there was a danger inherent in this idea of abstracting the idea behind the law as if the idea and the law were congruent, and once you had understood the idea, you didn't need the commandment itself. The sense, the ability to smell danger has always been particularly acute. And in here, they came out very strongly against Slifkin. This and that brings us to this subject. Now, the fact of the matter is, in my opinion, and I am not a great Torah scholar, so I will never get in the trouble. I would never presume to write on these subjects. I'm also not a scientist, which gives me two great pluses here. In areas about which I know little, I tend not to want to comment a great deal, even though I am a columnist, which by definition is a person who writes frequently about subjects about which he knows little. But in any event, I would not get up here and presume to address an audience at the Discovery Institute. But I think it's quite clear that ultimately the neo-Darwinian theory cannot be reconciled with the belief in Torah as we know it, of the divinity of the five books of Moses. There is a famous comment by Nachmanides at the end of the description of the Exodus from Egypt. There are two really seminal events, if you look in Jewish history. The two that we refer to most frequently in our prayers are the going out from Egypt and the giving of Torah at Sinai. And at the conclusion of the biblical account of going out from Egypt, Nachmanides says, the Torah went into this with great detail and in great description. Why? Because there are three principles, fundamental principles, which every Jew, every person must know and which are derived from the going out of Egypt. The first is that God has absolute dominion over the natural order. That you see through the miracles that were done in Egypt, that every aspect, whether it was some of the miracles took place in the air, some of them took place on the land, some of them took place from the heavens, wherever they came from, he has absolute dominion over the whole created universe. The second point is the truth of the prophecy of Moses, because so many, each time before two out of many of the plagues, Moses tells Paro, this is going to happen, and then it happened. And the Torah tells us, Moses said, this is going to happen, and then it happened. They also, my former high school debate partners in the audience, as they used to tell us in high school debate, first tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them that you told them. So the Torah does this in great detail here to emphasize the truth, the reliability of the prophecy of Moses. Any time in the Torah where that absolute truth of that prophecy was questioned, then you find, as when Korach led his rebellion, and he said, who told you to appoint your brother as the high priest. And Korach finds a punishment that never happened to anybody else before. The earth swallows him up. This is to know how serious it is to question that anything that came from Moses was his prophecy from God, given in a fashion that was never given to any other prophet. And the third point, Nachmanides says, is that he intervenes in the world. Jewish thought has no room for a divine clockmaker. We cannot be deist. God intervenes in the world. As he intervened to bring these plagues into the world, he is involved in the world. Otherwise, much of our prayer would be nonsensical. If we were praying but nothing can happen, it's all been set in motion, we're praying whatever we ask for, whatever we address God, it's simply meaningless. Know that he is involved in human history. In the Jewish view, the Jews, through their history, are the symbol, the story of God's revelation to mankind takes place preeminently through his relationship and treatment of the Jewish people. But this is the third major principle. And this is a principle which is hard, I would say impossible, to reconcile with the idea of randomness, the idea that the whole engine for the multiplicity, all the grandeur of creation, of organic creation, of living beings, is simply a process of random selection, of random generation of mutations, which has no other basis. It's simply randomly generated with no end in mind, with no goal, towards no end, with no direction, with no creator, or if you will, no designer. And that is a negation that the whole process is one that takes place without any possible involvement. Now, I think that there's I just saw an article in New Republic recently by somebody who's talking about Michael Behe's book, his latest book on intelligent design, of course, one of the preeminent fellows of the Discovery Institute. And he says, well, Behe's really started, he's conceded everything. Look what he's conceded. He's conceded that there's a 4.5 billion year old universe. He's conceded that there is evidence of evolutionary change and morphological change within species. He's conceded that there are vestigial traits that maybe have been left over in the process of some of those morphological changes. He's given up everything. The only thing he doesn't give up is the idea that random mutation provides the raw material for the evolutionary theory's view that evolutionary theory's view that random mutation provides the raw material for evolutionary change. That is the point. Everything else, as I mentioned at the outset, is we could find that we could live with. That is the point. That random mutation is the gas, as Coyne puts it, which drives everything in the evolutionary theory. That you can explain the only possible explanation of the proliferation of life in the world as we know it is through this random process which had no goal in mind. As one of the leading scientists said, it is a random process to which it had no goal. Man wasn't the summit. Man wasn't the goal. That there's no sense in which man represents the epiphany or the ultimate height of creation. That is something, by the way, which no one, however they interpreted the biblical verses, however they interpreted Genesis, that man is the summa of creation, that man is the goal to which creation was describing, that man is qualitatively different than any other aspect of the animal or plant kingdom. These are fundamental beliefs which no one could deny. This was George Simpson, one of the leading paleontologists, describing that he is the result of a random process which did not have him in mind. And that, in a nutshell, is where we must part company. All the other issues are not the essence. The essence is, what is the mechanism that powers whatever degree evolution has taken place? And that would still be, there could be large disputes about that, because we have, you know, you have things that are completely inexplicable in evolutionary theory too, and the fossil records are not definitive, or the fossil records are a complete mystery, the explosion of life in the Precambrian period and so forth and so on, where new species suddenly appear, the fact that most species, as far as we can tell, throughout their history on Earth were unchanged, and departed through some catastrophe, not because they generated some superior successors who were more evolutionarily developed. There are a lot of problems with how great is that degree of morphological change, but even if you'll concede that that takes place, there has some evidence of that. What is the mechanism which generates it? That is the fundamental question. Is it random or is it not random? And here is where we have parted company.
That was an excerpt of Jonathan Rosenblum's lecture, Is Darwin Kosher?, at Discovery Institute. For ID the Future, this is Annika Smith from the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.